now my great pleasure to introduce to you the Chair of the Transport Portfolio at the City of Melbourne, Councillor Nicholas Francis Gillies.
Wamanjika, Marambek Burundup, Wurundjeri Willamu, Liwiku Kulin, Yalimbu Ba Yirumboi. I pay my respects to the Wurundjeri traditional owners, their ancestors of the Kulin Nation, and their leaders past, present and emerging. I've been here 20 years, and the one thing I cannot at all get used to is being Australian, is the reluctance that we have to embrace the oldest culture on the planet. The woman that taught me those words said, I'm not only going to teach you those and no more, because I learnt them after I had to re-remember them, because I was removed from my mother was removed, and I couldn't remember all the words from my grandmother. So Auntie Pat said, well, I'll give you these, but I won't give you any more, because actually I haven't taught my grandchildren yet. And so I'd love you to share Wurrung as a language, because it needs to be learnt, but we need to relearn it first. And that's really difficult, isn't it? And so I think I want to talk about two things really in terms of transport today, and that story kind of relates them, is that I want to talk about the politics of it and some of the policy of it, and because I'm a politician, I'm a councillor. I didn't mean to be. I actually got the first Wurundjeri woman elected to Melbourne City Council, and because another councillor who was running who wanted her votes lied on her form, actually filled in the form incorrectly, she became ineligible. And so she didn't get her place. I've got 12 votes. I think I'm the least elected person in the country. I didn't really want to be here. She spent 24 hours here. I thought it was the big achievement of my life. And then for the next 4 years, I've been thinking what a mess I made. And I was one more white person trying to do the right thing too quick, pushing too fast and getting it wrong. Sorry, Brooke. I think the interesting thing for me is that when you put those things together, is that I came into this with no particular agenda and was given the transport policy. And I knew very little about transport. I mostly worked in welfare around the Brotherhood of St. Lawrence and then done the last 20 years in energy efficiency and climate change. So I know a bit about transport from a missions point of view. I know a bit about it from terms of poverty point of view, but I didn't really know much about it in terms of transport policy. And when I was given the role, it was from the former Lord Mayor who said to me, here, I'm giving you a transport strategy, nobody else wanted it. Look, do whatever you like, just don't mess with cars or parking. That's a political shit sandwich and I'm not willing to eat it. So that was my introduction to transport. And then I met transport professionals. And the thing I liked about transport professionals was their data-driven response to this. You know, the Lord Mayor at that time was wrong. He was wrong about lots of things, but he was particularly wrong about that. And as I learned, I realized that we were a long way away in terms of being the kind of cities that we needed to be based on what makes sense. But the trouble is every time I had the conversation, and some of them would be here, and they know I'm going to say it, I'm sure. Richard Smithers, who's taught me everything I know about transport, him and I talk, and I say, Richard, the trouble is you hate people that get in a car, and it comes out in every word that you say, you know. And so, it's like, how do we have this conversation that actually doesn't then make it about the facts of transport? How do we actually make it not a transport conversation? And so basically, I've spent the last 4 years talking about transport policy as a quality of life issue. And actually, to get my politicians to join me, they're really proud that in Melbourne, we're the most livable city in the world. We were until last year. So as the most livable city, you are not going to be the most livable city if actually you've got no space on the pavement to walk. And so my biggest critics of actually taking cars out of the city or reducing parking actually are the proudest people to say, but I live in the most beautiful city in the world. That's where my office is. That's where I'm a commentator on the news from. So there's a really interesting game about if you want to keep being proud of that, if you want to keep bringing people from around the world to be able to say, hey, let's not meet in my office, let's go down and sit in the shade of an elm tree and have a coffee on the street, you're going to need to help us create the space for that to happen. And I have been here for 4 years, I say, and I've been pushing on these buildings. We can't get them back. The pavements just won't go that way. We've got to go that way. Oh, parking. But don't worry, there's two lanes. If we move one of the lanes, there'll be less parking needed anyway. So I had this kind of conversation about saying, I see Melbourne as a city without cars. Not because I don't like cars, I drive a car. It's not because I don't like cars, it's because it's clearly obvious that if you go and stand on the corner of Collins, anywhere where there is public transport getting off, there is not enough room on the pavement. People are in the road. That is not safe. So we've had a conversation for 4 years that says, actually, with a transport policy, and during that time we put up parking, which we hadn't done for the term before or in this term. So we've increased the cost of parking. We've got a transport strategy that points to a future of all the little streets becoming streets that may not have cars, that points to the extension of segregated travel for public transport and also for bicycles. It talks about extending pavements to encroach and take road space that was untouchable. And it was unanimously voted for. My colleagues, I know, would not have voted for that when I arrived. But they are all passionately concerned about this remaining one of the most beautiful cities in the world. So we didn't have a transport conversation. We had a conversation about livability, about health, about safety, about space on the pavement for somebody to be in a wheelchair and not fall over a Lime scooter or hit a parked motorbike, but actually have the space to be able to do that. We recognise the issues of ageing and wanting to be able to put places where people, if they were walking up Collins, could stop and sit down. Well, you can't do that unless you have a wider pavement. Where's that going to come from? Parking. So what are you going to do? Maybe if you've got less cars. So suddenly in the transport policy, you were saying 50% of the cars in the city are driving through the city. They're just coming through. Let's see if we can change that. And it was not a fight. I've got to say, it was not a fight. So I think the thing that I've learned as a politician who's, you know, hasn't got many votes and won't ever do it again is that we really have to pick the conversation that you want to have on the issue. And if you really care about the issue, it will be driven by the data and the professionals that understand that issue. So I've learned in politics, politicians have views on everything. With no skill base, no experience data, they have a view and they think it's really important. So I think the thing is, be informed by the data, be informed by the professionals that are supporting you, but then to you professionals, let them tell the story with it. And it's not going to look like the story you want to tell. Because you'll want to talk about how important that segregated bike path is and pushing that car back and what it does not resonate as a story, and all you get is a pushback that says, you just don't want my car. I have told this story so many times with Neil Mitchell, for those of you who are not from this state. Neil Mitchell is one of our shock jocks that just loves cars and drives to work in his car, and he hates the fact that the Lord Mayor has, is, we're going against cars. Every time I have an interview, it's fun, I like it, and he laughs. Because every single time he talks about cars, I go, my job, Neil, is to get every single car that's in the way of you, slowing you down off the road so you can get to work quickly. He said, but you don't want me to get in the car. So I want you to get in the car. I just want everybody that's slowing you down in the way on a bloody tram so they're not in your way. I want bikes next to you so you can get here because you're important. You've got to get here and tell us all the crap that you tell us every day. You're important. I never said I don't want you in the car. I want you in a car. I actually even want, I want to charge you, Neil. I want the state to be charging you tens or hundreds of dollars to be in this city in your car so that you can actually wind down the window and go, I'm rich enough to have a car here. That's how special you are, Neil. Different debate, different story. So if I've learned anything in these 4 years, and I'm not going to be here doing this much longer, That would be my gift. Professionals, let storytellers tell the story. Storytellers, be guided by the professionals. Do each of your jobs. And honestly, that's not how it was happening here. And that's why we weren't getting progress. And it's why it was frightening to even make small bits of progress. So now some bits about policy. We've just done what I think is a extraordinarily strong transport strategy for 2030. I mean, it really names the issues, and it was blunt in it. And I'm really surprised it was unanimous in the end, because it was a strong document that was really forward-facing. And I think to what we're talking about today is that it talked, though, the story in it was all about quality of life. It was all about safety. It was all about health. It was about a beautiful city where you could meet people and you could connect. It was about tree canopy, and if you're going to need tree canopy, the parking in the middle of the road needs to go, because we can put tree canopy there, and that means with a wider pavement that can get underneath that tree canopy that you put in the middle, we can now sit and have coffee, we can slow down. So it talked about livability and quality of life. And so three, I think, but there, and as a consequence of that conversation, so just notice nothing in transport there, we got 40Ks everywhere in the city. Now, honestly, that was not possible 3 years ago. But it's like clear. And then when anyone came up to it, there was this massive evidence about what that speed limit reduction would mean for lives. But actually, it was about quality of life, and it was about health. It was about how we get more people on a cycle, and if we have more people on a cycle, that'd be less cars, and that meant we have pavements. That would be, remember the tree canopy with the coffee you're having? Remember that. That's what 40K is about. We committed to 70 kilograms of separated bike paths. Now, we know that at the moment from the north, 10%, 70 kilometers, did I say kilograms? Yeah. We are heavy in Melbourne. 70 kilometres of segregated bike path. We know, for example, in the north, that we get about 10% of people coming in on a bicycle. But the research says if we had separated bike paths, that could go to 30%. What an extraordinary difference that would make. One of the interesting things is that we called a climate emergency here in the city 4 months ago. And as a consequence of that, last month we came back and said, so what can we do? That 70 kilometres was in the 2030 plan to be delivered by 2030. When you put alongside it a climate emergency and we asked the city officers, what things could we do immediately to reduce reductions? Let's bring the 70 kilometres to 4 years. Because it was there, it was stated, it's clear that if you can change the emissions from 10% coming on a cycle to 30%, you actually get a significant win immediately. And of course, you've got safer cycle paths and you've got more people being healthy. So those are two things that we saw in it that made a really significant difference. And because they were there and they were clear and they were over time, and because of things like coronavirus or things that come and say, what can you do? Because they're there and they're clear and they've had unanimous support, you can pick them up and then go quickly, and there's not a debate. I think the things that we didn't see is that commercial service vehicles, commercial passenger vehicles, CPVs, 3 years ago, so we said technology is going to change. We said that, you know, our mobile phones are going to change. Apps are going to change the way the city works. Driverless vehicles are going to change the way the city works. And so we recognized that and said we have got to be willing to think about that. So I cycle in mostly. And I also have a motorbike, and I also have a car. And, you know, sometimes you use different forms of transport. In the last 3 years, it has become more dangerous to cycle in, I think, to the city. And I think it's because people are dropping off people and they are consistently pulling into bike lanes and they are not looking at what's in the bike lane. They are looking for the number on the street or the place in the street where they're dropping off. So 3 years ago, there were 8,000 in Victoria registered commercial passenger vehicles. 8,000. Today, there are 80,000. 80,000. That's 10 times more vehicles picking up and dropping off than there were 3 years ago, the time I've been in politics. 10 times. Put alongside that, the same thing that that app has delivered is that we have got a spike in motorbike deaths. Because that same app that's having brought those 80,000 vehicles dropping off has brought tens of thousands of people in vehicles picking up and dropping off food, many of them on motorbikes. Now, I have no evidence, we haven't got the evidence, that that spike over the last few years in motorbikes is people dropping and picking up food. But that's the spike in motorbikes in the city. They're parked on our pavements, they're blocking our pavements, they're blocking the bike paths, they're, you know. So I think that is the thing that if I've learned something else in here is that we, in that 3 years, have not changed at all the provision for commercial passenger vehicles to collect and drop off. Not one single change. We haven't extended the taxi ranks. We haven't made them smaller or bigger. We have made no kiss and drop spaces at all for Uber vehicles. So that means we've got 72,000 extra vehicles looking for a place to pick up and drop off, and the city as yet has made not one single change to accommodate that. So where are they? They're in our bike paths. And then what happens when they're in our bike paths? Our car goes round them, and to get round them, where is the car now? It's in our tram tracks, 3 accidents every single day. And once that happens, we've got thousands of people either not getting to work or not going home to pick up their kids. And we have not acted. So, some extraordinary news. We've got to think about the stories. You've got to know, because I won't be in transport in 6 months' time, because I'll go be back to climate change. But, you know, it is coming at a pace of change. And if you imagine in 5 years' time, you do exactly the same thing with driverless vehicles that are electric, then what will that mean for this city? Does that mean I can come in my car, I can now turn it over to Uber, I can get out of the car, and it now goes and works for me all day driving around the city, seeing if it can get a ride? Because if it can get a ride, it's cheaper than parking. That world's a nightmare. So there's obviously a really nice solution about it, is that we're not doing that and those vehicles are really doing all the last mile and they're being super used and we've got no cars and we're all sharing. All sharing vehicles? This is Australia. Let's see. Okay, I had a half an hour talk. I've got it down to just over 15 minutes. I'll take a couple of questions, I'm sorry, and then I'll get off if that's all right. Yes.
In regard to car park, so I live in Mildura, 500 miles away from one of the states. I get no information about where to park, how to get into Melbourne. Like, I've got to take my car, so my car's got to come into the city and then I pay a fortune to come in here and spend a fortune.
Yes.
So what do you do about people, and what are you doing to let people in the country know? How do you park in Melbourne? Like, where's the parking stations where you can park your car safely, where it won't get ripped off? That's the other problem in Melbourne. And can you leave it there, jump on a train, and get into the city? There's nothing like that happening. I've got to drive into the city and try and find a car park and pay a fortune for it. So where's the information flow to look after people outside of Melbourne rather than just take for granted that everybody knows, because they don't?
That's a great question. In terms of the exact answer about where the information is, I'm not sure. I'm sure we've got information, but I don't know that. Somebody here will know that, and this gentleman down the front from Mildura, will they go and help him? Let me say a couple of things. I mean, there are this current government spent a fortune on putting lots of car parks for train stations, in particular electorates, this last
voting rounds. So there's lots of places where you can park at stations free and safe and do the last bit of the transport into the city. I don't have that list right now, and I'm sorry, I don't know how you get it. They're full by 7 o'clock, she says. So I think I might leave that to you and say I'm really not the expert on that, and I don't have that detail, and there will be some people here. What I would say is that we're not saying no cars. I'm not saying no cars. What we've got 40% of the car parks in our private car parks in this city that are empty every single day. 40% of the car parks in buildings every single day empty. There is more than enough place to put cars in secure places. Trouble is, we haven't worked out that app, and I'm not sure that I'm in a hurry to work that app out, because I really would like you to park, you know, park somewhere outside the city and do the last bit on the train to get in. So yes, you're probably right. We may need to be much better at telling that story as a city for interstate visitors. And that's something I'll find out how we do, because I don't know. And I'll see if we can improve that. It's a good question.
My name's Mandy Mees. I'm from the National Transport Commission. We're a national policy and law reform agency in land transport. We're actively working on, we talk about the fight for the curbside,
yes,
and all the different types of devices and vehicles, as well as pedestrians and many, and some with who may not be able to hear or see very well. So we're actively working on this at the moment. Do you have any perspectives on, you know, how we can start to manage all of the different both people who are walking, but also people who need mobility devices, and also people who are looking for more active transport methods to get to where they need to go. Do you have just general perspectives on that? That would be really useful.
I would really encourage you to have a look at the transport strategy. It's got in there some really great information about what is blocking our pavements. So two things. One is just the phrase is a problem for me. Fight for it. Fight for the curbside. So I'm over the fight. You know, people want the fight, particularly car owners want a fight. So if you want a fight, name it as a fight and you'll get one. I actually think we really got to be careful about when we're lobbying, what we're lobbying for, and whether we want the outcome or we want the fight. So I just reflect on that. You know, I have give Neil Mitchell his car, charge him to get in, let him get there, let him say how clear the roads are at the moment, and know, as a consequence of that, we've doubled the amount of people on trams, on trains, and you know, cycling in. In terms of the things that are blocking the pavements at the moment, you know, really motorbikes is the biggest, and in this state you can put motorbikes on it, and in the city you can put them. So we are actively, and it's something we have done, we're right now building lots of on-street parking, free parking for motorbikes to get them off. We're removing some of the things, like we had quite a lot of buildings that were selling newspapers and stuff. Those are models that aren't really working. A couple of them still do, but most of them don't. So we're trying to remove that clutter. We're looking at signs for shops. We're wanting tables and chairs to stay out there because we believe that's the livability of the city. But we are really trying to do a lot about clutter. I'm really concerned about things like Lime scooters. I've seen they fall over. They're really easy to transport. You can't see them if you've got a disability or you're vision impaired or they're really clutter. They're really fun, by the way. I used one in Oakland recently. I loved it. But they are definitely clutter. The bikes that we've just used with Jump, we've got really quite good geofencing on them. We're not putting them in places. We've actually, the geofencing allows them, when you're on bike paths that have got a 10k speed limit, to actually take off the power of the bike, so you can't go almost faster than 10k. So there's some really interesting things that we're going to be able to do with technology to kind of improve that space. But there's some great stuff in terms of how to tell that story in the transport strategy. Well, yes, I think that's the last one, and then I'll get off. Have a real expert.
Ken Parker, representing CODA Victoria. I'm just wondering, in the context of what you've said, if there's a way that you can suggest that we can turn around attitudes in Melbourne towards sustainable transport, such as cyclists. At the moment, from my observations, there's an attitude among a lot of drivers, and I'm a driver like you myself, but that cyclists are purely a nuisance and that they all disobey the law and the best thing we could do is get rid of them. Whereas I think you've talked about the truth, that if we can get people on bikes and public transport, we can actually make it better for the people who really should be and need to be driving, and also make it safer, because while we've had amazing success in vehicle safety, unfortunately cyclists are dying and being injured in exponentially increasing numbers.
Yeah, I think I've tried to address that really in what I've said. I think there is, you know, I now cycle. I'm a couple of kilos lighter. I'm a 58-year-old man. It makes sense. I get into work. You know, I live in Clifton Hill. Jackie's my counsellor. You know, I get here the quickest way. I live next to a train station and near a tram stop. The quickest way for me to get to this place every single day is on a bike, and the quickest way to get home, I've got a councillor that lives literally in the same street to me. He leaves in a car every week. I leave on my bike every week. I get home before him every single week, and that's when it's after 7 o'clock, when the, you know, after 7 or 8 or 9 after the chamber. There is no doubt about the argument. I think the thing for me is that there is bad behaviour of drivers and there is bad behaviour as a cyclist. I think for those of us who are advocating, we tend to advocate like it's some kind of religion. Let go of the religion. It's not a religion. It's a transport choice. And actually make it a quality of life conversation and change the way you talk about it. It is not a religion. It doesn't help. We're not in a fight. We're all trying to get on here. Thank you very much.